you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning. This is Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Julia Paskin in for Austin Cross. Thank you for being with us this Friday morning. We have a great show for you today. In a moment, we are going to talk about this storm forecast to hit the region as early as this evening. It's going to last through the weekend. But first, we want to give a mention to Louis Gossett Jr., the first Black man to win an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor and an Emmy winner for his role in the seminal TV miniseries Roots, has died. He was 87 years old. His family reports that the actor passed away in Santa Monica this morning. No cause of death was revealed. An Oscar win for Gossett was in 1983 for his role in An Officer and a Gentleman. Okay, moving on to the storm. As early as Easter holiday weekend, we are preparing for another storm in what has been already a very wet year. Northern California is going to get hit first this morning. It'll reach Southern California by Friday evening. Strong gusts of winds are also expected. According to the National Weather Service, places including the Napa Valley to the LA Basin can expect to receive about an inch of rain, while the Sierra and even mountains in Southern California are projected to receive anywhere from 6 inches to 2 feet of snow. So what can Californians expect from this weekend storm, and how has this year's wet season affected our snowpack, which is going to get measured again in just a few more days? Joining us today on Air Talk is Jacob Margolis, the science reporter here at LAist and someone who's been following all of these storms all along. Jacob, good morning.
Hey.
Thanks so much for being with us. So tell us what you know about the storm so far.
You laid it out perfectly. It's basically through Sunday, we're going to be dealing with wet weather and very windy conditions as well. Flash flood watch. A flood watch is in effect for basically all of Southern California. We've seen the winter weather warnings. I might not want to take a trip up to the mountains over the next couple of days. But then next week, things will warm up and start to dry out, which will be awfully nice. But in the meantime, we really do have to look out for land movement, because obviously we've experienced quite a bit of rain over the past couple of months, and soils are saturated.
Speaking of that land movement, can you tell us what's happened over with Topanga Canyon and where that stands?
Yeah, so Topanga Canyon's been shut down since March 9th, and it's because in the lower portion below like the little town area that people are familiar with, there's been a landslide. Now, it didn't seem to be a particularly humongous landslide. And a lot of the time in these canyons during rains, we will see shallow landslides, like some rocks and dirt go into the road, and then crews will come in and push it all away. The problem is, since then, Caltrans has used a drone, and they've actually spotted a gigantic crack above the initial slide, which indicates that it is a deep-seated landslide kind of waiting to take off. Now, what is a deep-seated landslide? Well, we've talked about them quite a bit over the past year, because we saw in Palos Verdes, it destroyed some homes there. And basically what happens is the water percolates deep, 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 deep into the soil, and then compromises layers of soil, their ability to stick together. And so right now they can't stick crews down there because it could give out at any time. They can't do anything about it until things dry out and they know the soil's stable. But, they don't have a timeline for when that'll happen, obviously.
Jacob, you mentioned Palos Verdes. Are there any other areas that are particularly vulnerable to this kind of land movement?
I mean, it's really anywhere that is especially steep, has a history of slides and movement, especially during rains. I'm thinking across the transverse ranges, so the Santa Monica Mountains, like all the way down to, Santa Barbara. I know there were some other slides that did pop up in Big Rock, Porta Marina, State Route 150, Corral Canyon. You know, a lot of these, they're really steep, and we've, cut roads through them. And so it makes sense that some of them are given out. And obviously, we're always watching Palos Verdes, because since its inception, since they built Rancho Palos Verdes and started developing the peninsula, like in the original documents for it, they say, hey, this is a big landslide area.
Wow. So yeah, we had the heads up and didn't exactly plan accordingly. Is that correct?
I mean, I would say that that has been the case for a lot of, you know, how do I say this? We decide the risk for certain things is worth it if we have wonderful views and beautiful homes and stuff, mm-hmm. especially across earthquake country.
Gotcha. Okay, there's also a flood watch. Do you know anything about the vulnerabilities there in terms of our region where we could see flooding more than any other places?
Yeah, low-lying areas, you know, any streams, rivers, if you happen to be, you know, have a low-lying home and have experienced flooding in the past couple months, you know, the possibility is very real.
So where are we now with the reservoirs and the snowpack ahead of this storm?
Yeah, reservoirs are looking good. Snowpack is at average. When we're looking out in terms of water for the remainder of the year, as of right now, it does look like we will be able to meet, or like Metropolitan Water District will be able to meet customer needs. So we shouldn't see restrictions. That said, our rainy season started off very dry. And so we might see decreased runoff because that soil, the dry soil underneath, hasn't necessarily been saturated yet. And so it'll suck up some of that moisture as the snow does melt. Really, it's not nearly as wet as last year. So we're not going to see the flooding we saw in like the Central Valley and whatnot. Not very likely, or not at the same scale. What I would say is, and I found this interesting talking to a lot of officials and scientists around this for piece we have coming up on Monday. The last period of drought from 20 to 20, 22, 23 really put the fear of God in like everyone and changed how we think about water in the state in a major way following the previous big drought, because we were running out of water. And so what I'm hearing from just everyone across the board is like, yeah, this is another wet year, but we're going to assume the following year is going to be extremely dry. And also the hotter weather is continuing to tax our environment quite a bit, and, you know, increases the water demand on plants and in the soil. So we could slip back into drought next year. It is not a foregone conclusion that we will be wet forever. The good news is that we do have a couple years worth of water, but we have overdrawn our groundwater, as people know, and a lot of our landscapes are just not going to recover from what we've gone through. So people need to think about it, probably not from year to year, but in terms of like, this is now it. We need to assume dry weather is always coming.
I've heard this storm described as the last big storm of the rainy season. We did have a wet summer last year. Do you think we could see more tropical storms coming up over the summer months?
Your guess is as good as any one of the experts out there, because no one was predicting that storm would come up, and it was a standout event. You know, we were talking about records set and everything during the summer. Usually we're solidly in the dry season by then. So your guess is as good as mine. April 1st is a big date in the water world, though, because that's when we assume that snowpack will reach its peak across the state, and snowpack is important for water. You know, we might still see some storms here and there, but probably, you know, this one coming up is a bit uncharacteristically like cold and heavy. So things should start to dry out and warm up pretty quickly.
And will you be watching the snowpack measurement on Tuesday, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the decision about water availability is pretty much set right now. We could see allocations change. Don't ask me to explain them because I still don't understand them. We could see allocations change, like how much water is available to different municipalities over the next month or so. However, I think we're pretty much there. And so I don't expect they're doing their final measurement on April 2nd for the state, just to kind of put a pin in it and be done with the rainy season.
That is Jacob Margolis, the science reporter here at LAist. You can read all of Jacob's reporting at LAist.com and listen for his story on Monday. We're also going to be tracking the storm throughout the weekend, so stick with us both on the radio, the LAist app, and LAist.com. Jacob, thank you so much.
Thanks.
This is Air Talk. Back in a moment.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
This is Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Julia Paskin in for Austin Cross. Thanks for being with us this Friday. So it is Tsunami Preparedness Week in California, and though the state is a region well known for its earthquakes, the role of tsunamis in the state has been somewhat downplayed. The threat is much higher in the northern portion of the state, and even higher in the Cascadia subduction zone of Oregon and Washington, but large waves could cause damage in Southern California, and that damage may be exacerbated by the assumption that we are safe from such a natural event. So today we are talking about tsunami preparedness. We're going to look into the prehistoric written record and the future threat of tsunamis in California. And joining us to talk about all of this is Kostas Sinoulakis, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Southern California and also director of the USC Tsunami Research Center. Kostas, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us. So, I was looking at a tsunami preparedness map or tsunami projection, and I was having a little bit of difficulty understanding the differences between the different colors on the map. Can you kind of just give us an idea of exactly how close to the coast you have to be to potentially be impacted by a tsunami?
Well, it really depends where the event comes from, whether it's what we call a teletsunami, which means a tsunami that comes from really far away, like a tsunami that impacts us from Chile or Alaska or Japan, or whether it is a local tsunami. Local tsunamis are more threatening per se because they may penetrate further inland. And the maps that we have are good maps in the sense that they give an approximate line where people should evacuate to and of potentially flooded areas.
So it can really range depending on the event.
It can range depending on the event, and this is where we hope the warning centers will come in. For tsunamis that come in from far away, we have anywhere from 10 to 20 hours of warning, because it takes that long for a tsunami to come in from Chile or from Alaska. But for a tsunami that happens locally, just offshore, we're only going to have minutes worth of warning. If at all.
Is it because of the proximity, or are those underwater land movements off the coast, are they also stronger?
Both. One is the proximity. The closer the source of the tsunami is, the smaller the propagation time, the less time it takes to strike the coast. The other part that we have is that in your previous segment, you mentioned the Palos Verdes landslides. Not only landslides happen onshore in Palos Verdes, but they happen offshore. I mean, if you continue off Palos Verdes and you go close to what we call the continental shelf, there is evidence of landslides that have taken place 2,000-4,000 years ago, and those generated large tsunamis.
Can you give us some more examples of tsunamis that have hit our coast here in California and maybe more recent history?
If we talk in the recent history, if we start going back from the 1946, which is the Aleutian tsunami. This is also, the Aleutian starts from the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. This is an event that ushers, if you will, the modern era of tsunami warnings in the United States and around the world. The United States has been a leader in issuing tsunami warnings, but for the first 50 years or so, they were primarily focused to Hawaii. And then people started realizing that the western coast also had a very high risk of tsunamis. So just going back from the in the last 50, 70 years, Southern California was hit by a tsunami from Chile in 1960, from Alaska in 1964. In fact, 1964, the tsunami hit also Northern California and Crescent City. If memory serves me, about 20 people died. There was extensive damage in Crescent City. And then moving forward, in the Again, when we started having these mega thrust earthquakes around the Pacific, in 2010, Southern California was hit. 2011 from the Japan tsunami, and then again in 2015 from the Chilean tsunami. In 2015, most of the impact was in Ventura Harbor. In 2010, most of the impact was in the port of LA.
And how substantial was that impact for folks that, you know, they may say, what's a tsunami hit? I didn't know that happened. How substantial was that impact?
This is a very good question, and we really need to educate people about this. It so happened that the impact from these tsunamis was only concentrated inside the ports. And inside the ports, there were very, very strong currents. And, you know, some ships were out of control. It looked like as if we saw what happened with the accident in Baltimore, Maryland, where you had a ship just go a little bit out of the air, out of control, and you see what the consequences were. Imagine inside the port, these giant ships going out of control because of the very strong tsunami currents. Because one of the things that we found out, both in 2010 and then in 2015, even small tsunamis of the order of less than a foot, hardly noticeable, you know, along the coastline, they can generate really strong currents inside the ports. And these currents can have catastrophic consequences, just like what happened in Baltimore. It's just that we were lucky. In 2010, and there was a warning, so the operations in the port of LA sat down. In 2015, there was impact in Ventura Harbor, but of course Ventura Harbor is much smaller. You don't really get this behemoth 1,000-foot-long ships moving around. But what really concerned me was in 2010, there is this movie taken from the Santa Monica Pier in Southern California, where you see the harbinger warning of a tsunami. You see the shoreline withdrawing, and it looks like a fast receding tide. So people are on the beach. Unfortunately, Santa Monica at the time had not evacuated the beaches. So people are sitting on the beach and they're watching this shoreline recession. They're watching this tide moving out, fast moving tide. Within 5 minutes, the tide moves out the order of about maybe about a quarter of a mile, which is very unusual. What do people do? They see this fast receding tide, and instead of heading for high ground, they just linger around, they go in, they try to see all the little critters that the fast moving tide, the fast receding tide has exposed on the seafloor, and they're just sitting there. And then luckily, when the main wave of the tsunami came, it was very small, so people didn't get hurt. But this was, we never know exactly for these tsunamis that are, you know, very far away, exactly what is the size of the wave that's going to strike the coastline, particularly when this wave is going to be less than, 2 feet. We're going to know if the wave that strikes is going to be 10, 20, 30 feet high. But when it comes out to these smaller waves, which are more common and which can affect people, there we really do not have, our models cannot really differentiate and tell anyone with any degree of safety that the tsunami is not going to flood the entire Santa Monica Beach or the entire Venice Beach any of the Southern California beaches.
I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about how to prepare. You mentioned the shoreline receding, that if you see that, do not go and investigate, move to high ground. What else should folks know, either as an indication or once they've realized that this is happening, what they should do?
Right. The other telltale indicator that there is a tsunami imminent is the an earthquake that lasts, earthquake shaking, that lasts more than 15 seconds. The reason is that the bigger the earthquake, the longer the shaking. I mean, we should think of earthquakes and earthquake faults as being giant zippers. If you have a really long fault, like, for example, the San Andreas fault, you get a magnitude 8 or 8.5 earthquake, the shaking will last likely from 3 to 3 to 3.5 minutes. it's going to be a lot of shaking. I mean, if you have a small earthquake at a magnitude less than 6, the shaking will last, you know, 1 or 2 seconds. So as a community, we set up the, I mean, we say that if the shaking lasts more than 15 seconds, this means that this is, you're experiencing a fairly strong local tremor, which if you're on the beach, you don't know where the tremor is. Is it inland? Is it offshore? So if you're on the beach and you experience earthquake shaking that lasts more than 15 seconds, this is the time to move to high ground. In practically every Southern California, every California beach, there are tsunami evacuation signs, and you just follow them and you just you know, move away from the beach. I mean, there's no need to move miles inland or to move to, you know, up the mountains. But in most places, I mean, the tsunami hazard zones are clearly marked. So all you need to do is just move out of the hazard zone and wait there for at least half an hour until you get an official notification that there is no hazard from a tsunami.
We have about a minute left. I was hoping you could tell us where we are in terms of our notification system, when a tsunami comes, and how listeners can get tapped into that.
Right. We're doing very well when it comes in to tsunamis that come in from, what I said earlier, the teletsunamis that come in from different parts across the Pacific. We're not doing equally well when it comes to local tsunamis because of the time. I mean, it takes time for the warning centers to actually analyze the earthquake, make a determination whether it is the kind of earthquake that can generate a tsunami, and then issue a warning, and then this warning to trickle down and come to the people. What we need is, reverse 911. There was a nationwide test in the aftermath of the Maui fires. There was a nationwide test back in October, where the emergency alert, the wireless emergency alert system was tested on cell phones. And we hope this has never been tested in terms of a real tsunami, with a real tsunami. And we hope that the system is going to be ready, operational, and people will have the warnings in the unlikely event we get a tsunami in California.
That is Kostas Sinoulakis, professor of civil and environmental engineering at USC, where he's also director of the Tsunami Research Center. Kostas, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Evelyn.
Well, we are here on Air Talk on a Friday. Appreciate you being with us. We're going to take a quick break, but after that break, we're going to talk about something called lab-grown meat or cultivated meat. It's kind of an interesting, sticky thing. We're going to talk about where we're at with that technology and where it's fitting into politics. So if you have questions about what lab-grown meat is, the benefits, the drawbacks, anything like that, give us a call coming up at 866-893-5722 or atcomments@las.com for an email. This is Air Talk. Back in a moment.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
This is Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. Julia Paskin with you in for Austin Cross. Thank you for being with us this Friday. So, as the world's population increases, the Food and Agricultural Organization projects that global meat consumption will rise by 14% by the year 2030. The U.S. alone uses about 1 billion acres to graze cattle for meat production. Yet even with the current large-scale meat production, it is unlikely that the current industry will be able to withstand the growing demand for animal protein. A solution may be the production of lab-grown or what they call cultivated meat. This is when stem cells from an animal are grown and structured into muscle, connective, and fatty tissue to produce meat that can be consumed. Although two companies, Upside Foods and Good Meat, have received FDA approval, lab-grown meat is not currently available for sale at grocery stores or restaurants. And worries over this growing industry's impact on ranchers and conventional meat production has led to several states, most recently Florida, to introduce legislation that would ban cultivated meat sales. Now, here's where my personal interest comes in. I've been a vegetarian for about 30 years. It's a product of when I was a kid, when kids find out that... And any kids listening, you might want to ask your parents about this. Chicken, the animal, and chicken, the food, are the same thing. This is crushing for some children. Most of us get over it. I did not. So by the time I was 8, I decided to become a vegetarian. But I still very much like the taste of meat. And as I got older, worried about finding good sources of protein. And I heard about, 30 years ago, I heard about the seeds of lab-grown meat. And my child brain went, I cannot wait for this to happen. I'm going to eat meat again once it is done humanely and grown in a petri dish. Here we are 30 years later, and I don't really know how to feel about it, either as a vegetarian or someone with environmental concerns or economic concerns for industries in general. So this is why partially we are discussing this today. And we have a couple of excellent guests to help us unpack this about the cultivated meat industry and the growing concerns. We have Larisa Zimbaroff, a journalist and author of Technically Food, which is a great title, Inside Silicon Valley's Mission to Change What We Eat. And also with us is David Block, professor of viticulture, enology, and chemical engineering at UC Davis. Larisa and David, welcome.
Thank you, Julia.
So where are we with lab-grown meat? Larisa, can you tell us where we are? The FDA has approved some of it. Some restaurants were serving it, but they're not currently. Why can't we access it as a public consumer?
Wow, that's a great question, because really few people could access it even when it was at two restaurants in the country, one in Washington, D.C. and one in San Francisco. Neither are serving the meat any longer. But the companies, Upside Foods and Eat Just, both say that they are working hard to improve their processes and to perfect what they're making. But frankly, it's just too expensive for them to make. And I think that everybody's watching their money in the bank. And, you know, the economy and the climate is not great for selling something so innovative.
Was it the cost that made the restaurants take it off the menu?
It was the cost. They're not going to tell me exactly, but my expert opinion is that the cost for the companies to produce it, so not for the restaurants, but for the companies to produce it. And it was being sold also in Singapore, and it isn't right now. Again, the company, which is Eat Just, says it's working on improving its systems and making it cheaper, making it more affordable for them to produce, not for the consumer to buy, because I think someone would pay most anything to try something so exotic right now.
David, I'm wondering if you could tell us what kind of process it takes to create growing meat in a lab and what you guys are working on at UC Davis.
Sure. Well, certainly this is a very new process. I mean, most of these companies that Larisa just mentioned are less than 10 years old, and the technology is really new. So, I mean, when you're talking about cultivated meat, essentially what you're talking about is taking a biopsy of muscle from an animal. It's usually the way stem cells are isolated. And those stem cells are grown in progressively larger stainless steel tanks with the nutrients to allow the cells to grow. And you grow them larger and larger scale until you get to the largest scale, where you then try and differentiate them into muscle cells, fat cells, and connective tissue cells, which are the three types of cells in meat. And then you either would squeeze them together into something like a hamburger in the case of beef, or try and do something like 3D print them into a marbled steak, if that's what you're shooting for. So that's kind of what the process looks like in general. It's easier said than done, and there's still a lot of issues that that companies are trying to work through.
And is this something that you're researching at UC Davis?
Yes. Yeah, so we've had the Cultivated Meat Consortium here at UC Davis for about 4 years, and we just launched an even larger group, the Integrative Center for Alternative Meat and Protein, a couple months ago, to really work through all the technical hurdles, and there are several, for large-scale commercialization. ICAMP is the Integrative Center for Alternative Meat and Protein, is a large organization that includes another 5 institutions around the country, including UCLA. And really, it takes people from all kinds of disciplines, from stem cell scientists to muscle physiologists and meat specialists and biochemical engineers and economists and food scientists, to really solve these problems.
Larissa, going back to you, I understand that you've actually tried lab-grown meat. Can you describe what that experience was like?
I have tried. I've tried it quite a bit, and including the seafood that's being created by Wild Type, which is making salmon in San Francisco. But the meat so far, the 2 companies that are approved for sale of their chicken. And just to be clear, the cells that they're using to grow chicken meat, it could be coming from an egg as well. So they don't just have to get it from the animal. And the chicken has incredible texture. I tried it both with Upside and with Just in Alameda, and it's got the sort of the threads of protein that, Julia, maybe you are missing. You may not even remember it, but from age 8.
Right.
But it's got this like great like grip and tug that you expect from meat. Maybe it doesn't have quite the flavor you may expect, but if it was to be served, I believe, in a composed dish, I don't think you would ever miss the real thing or even realize that you weren't eating the real thing. I think it would take a true expert or maybe a 3 Michelin star chef to pick it out differently. Mm-hmm.
If you have questions, comments about lab-grown or so-called cultivated meat, 866-893-5722 is the number to call. You can also leave your comments at atcomments@laist.com and include your location and first name if you could. David, can you tell us more about, you mentioned taking a biopsy, and Larissa, you also mentioned it could come from an egg cell. There are some concerns about it's staying a humane practice if we're still originally cultivating these cells from a living animal. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think there are multiple approaches. I mean, the idea is that somehow you need to isolate stem cells. And the reason that you need stem cells for this process is you need to grow these cells for probably 30 or 40 doublings of those cells in order to get to what's projected to be the production scale. So the cells have to grow for quite a while. And most cells in your body or an animal's body don't actually grow forever. And so stem cells do have those characteristics. Now, adult stem cells that would be isolated from a muscle, like a biopsy, will grow for probably on the order of maybe a third of the doublings that you need to, but they're more easily differentiate into things like muscle and fat and connective tissue. The other option or direction that people go is one that Larissa mentioned, and that's the idea of starting from an embryo, whether it's from an egg for chicken or an embryo for beef or something like that. And the advantage of some of those embryonic stem cells is that they will actually grow forever, more or less, if you give them the right nutrients and the right environment. The problem is it takes a lot more effort, and it's way more complicated to differentiate them into muscle and fat and connective tissue. And so it's a trade-off. What you'd love is a cell that grows for a really long time and differentiates very easily. But in nature, those things are sometimes diametrically opposed. In terms of, you know, the ethics of doing that, I think if you take a biopsy, you're not slaughtering an animal to do that. If you're starting from embryonic stem cells, you're sacrificing an embryo to do that. There is a question, I guess, you know, ethically you could think about is doing a biopsy or sacrificing one embryo to make tons and tons of meat, a good trade-off ethically.
We're speaking with David Block, professor of viticulture, enology, and chemical engineering at UC Davis, and doing research on cultivated meat, and also with Larissa Zimbaroff, a journalist and author of the book Technically Food: Inside Silicon Valley's Mission to Change What We Eat. Larissa, I'm curious, can you tell us more about this movement to ban lab-grown meat in states, most recently Florida? What's the motivation there?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by what's happening in the state legislature right now. There are bills that have passed in Arizona, Florida, Alabama, and Tennessee, making it fining people for selling cultured meat, which it's so far from becoming something at the supermarket. Like, I'm thinking it's maybe a decade, if not two decades, if at all. You know, it's going to be, like David said, so complex and diametrically opposed to making this happen. Although there are some even newer companies that I think are making some headway in ways that we'll learn about down the road. But this legislature is really going to stifle this innovation that's coming from, you know, just founders that are so passionate about doing something different for the world. And the claim here from these states is that they are trying to protect their agriculture industry, and their ranchers and their cattle industry is what they're trying to protect. It's even more interesting because big meat manufacturers like JBS, Cargill are all investors in these companies. And so I'm a bit surprised that they're such strong presences in our food that they haven't found a way to get to these bills and sort of stop them, because we're so far from it, but these bills are like as if it's going to happen tomorrow, and it's not.
There was some concern expressed from NASA. How did they come into this conversation?
Oh yeah, this is a great point, Julia, because NASA is how cell cultured meat began. So I can't remember the year, unfortunately, but a school in Long Island was doing research funded by NASA and growing goldfish cells. And it was, can we grow goldfish cells to feed astronauts? And they came upon the ability that they could do this. Aha, yes, we can do this, but this is too much work and it's not going to be worth it. So they stopped. So they were successful. It didn't go anywhere. And then it ended. And NASA, if they want to send people to Mars, they have to figure out ways to feed them. And if they could grow it with simple nutrients and with no weight or little weight, then that's what they want. And so they are working. I know in Alabama, they're working to put, or sorry, at a federal level, they're working to put a language in there that allows for research. Now, I tried before this call to find out if the research was just for NASA, if it was research at any school, which would affect David and UCLA and other UC schools, Tufts. There's so many universities that are getting involved into this arena. So I'll be interested to see where that goes.
And something that we have not touched upon, David, I'm hoping you can fill this in for us. We've talked about the issue of cruelty. We've talked about some of the health benefits, some of the economic impact. We haven't talked about the environmental potential benefits of adopting something like this. What could that look like?
Well, certainly there's a environmental impact of growing animals conventionally for meat production. I think, you know, the interesting thing about, you know, focusing on cultivated meat is there's probably not really enough information out there to understand how sustainable it's going to be when it's done at large scale, because right now it's not being produced at large scale at any of these companies. That's their challenge right now. I mean, on the face of things, it looks like it should be more sustainable than growing animals conventionally, because, you know, you feed an animal and not all of the food stays in the animal. You slaughter the animal and you're not using all of it for meat. And, you know, if you take the cells out of a fermenter and cultivated meat production, you could theoretically use all of them for meat. But I think it's not really that simple. When you look at the environmental impact of producing meat in any way, including cultivated meat, you have to think as broadly as possible. What's the environmental impact of growing the raw materials and transporting the raw materials and so forth? And what's the energy use and things like that of producing that cultivated meat product? I think in general, the studies, the preliminary studies that are out using the information that is available now, indicate that probably growing meat through a cultivated meat process is going to be as sustainable or maybe more sustainable than growing it conventionally. But that's going to rely on a lot of process development and a lot of new knowledge to grow cells on very sustainable raw materials, things like agricultural waste streams or plant extracts and things like that, which is not really possible yet. So I think, you know, the jury's still out. I think one of our jobs at UC Davis and iCamp is to really create as much information in the public domain so that people can do these analyses. But I will say either way, the demand for meat globally in the next 25 years is projected to be anywhere from 25 to 100% more. I think the idea that conventional meat is going to go away anytime soon is probably wrong. I think if anything, it may increase. But we're going to need to have all these other approaches, cultivated meat, plant-based meat, fungal-based meat, and so forth, to really make up that the extra supply to meet the demand globally.
And if folks are wondering, fungal-based meat, that is actually sold in stores. I think it's the Corn Company that you can find in most grocery stores. That
exactly.
is David yeah. Block. Sorry about that, David. But we do have to wrap up now. So thank you so much to David Block, professor at UC Davis, currently researching cultivated meat, and also to Larisa Zemberoff, author of Technically Food, Inside Silicon Valley's Mission to Change What We Eat. Thank you to you both.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the tradition of breaking the Ramadan fast with samosas. Stay with us. Back in a moment. This is Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. Julia Paskin with you in for Austin Cross. Thank you for being with us this Friday morning. Samosas, sambusik, sambusa, so many words for dough stuffed with savory or sweet filling. Come Ramadan, the Islamic holy month, where Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset. For many, at iftar, that's the meal that breaks the fast, at their dinner tables, the triangle-shaped golden pastry is a must-have. Ramadan started March 10th and continues through April 9th. But how did this popular street food in some African, Arab, South Asian, and Southeast Asian countries become a Ramadan staple? Joining us to discuss the connection and the dish, and I should say two dish about samosas, is LAist reporter Yusra Farzan, who wrote a piece on LAist about the special connection between samosas and Ramadan. Yusra, good morning.
Good morning, Julia.
So tell us, how did you get the idea to write this piece?
So I've sort of noticed, as somebody who fasts, I do identify as Muslim, that pretty much every iftar table, whether I'm, you know, I've gone somewhere to a restaurant, to someone's house, or even at our house, samosas is such a staple. You know, it's something you don't really like assume is going to be this Ramadan thing, but just notice that it was always on everybody's iftar tables. And then, you know, in the lead up to Ramadan, I would notice people coming together to have samosa making parties, and where they prep for the holy month by making, you know, samosas together, just because it's a very tedious process. You know, you got to get the pastry strip and then fold it. It takes time. So they make it, you know, beforehand, and then they freeze it and use it during the holy month. So I noticed the parties, noticed that it was almost on pretty much every iftar table, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of, you know, race. So I wanted to explore it in my story.
And in your reporting, what did you learn about the evolution of samosa in the iftar tradition?
Yeah. So somebody that I spoke with, she was telling me about how, you know, her grandmother used to make it, her mother used to make it, and now she does it with her daughter. So there's definitely something that has been passed down from generation to generation. One of my interviewees told me that, you know, the first earliest instance of samosa that, you know, she found when she was doing research was, you know, during the 14th century traveler Ibn Battuta's time. So he wrote about it, and he wrote about, you know, having this in India. But then somebody else that I spoke to said, you know, it originated in Persia and then sort of, you know, was taken along, you know, by Arab traders to places like India during the spice trade. So it's really fascinating how, you know, this one dish is sort of, you know, it's shown up in different, you know, times of history, and then now how it shows up in different forms, like with different fillings and things like that, depending on the culture, on different iftar tables.
Tell us about that. How do the flavors and the fillings vary from cultures?
Yeah. So I grew up in the Middle East with a lot of Pakistani friends. I've sort of seen how South Asians do it and Arabs. So South Asians will typically have a spice filling. So they'll do ground meat with potatoes, there's cilantro, there's green chilies for a little kick. Whereas Arabs tend to they have a sweeter taste because they use pomegranate molasses. And then Syrians actually have a sweet version. The sabosek is filled with walnuts and cinnamon sugar. So it's like a sweet, it's got a, you know, sweet kick to it. Now, my recipe is very unique. Sort of I've borrowed from all these different cultures. Mine is ground meat and it has cumin, sort of like an ode to Arab culture. And then I also use, Kashmiri chili powder, which is found in most Indian and Middle Eastern grocery stores here in Southern California, sort of an ode to, you know, the South Asian culture. I also add carrots in mine. And then because of my Sri Lankan heritage, I use lime juice in my, in my filling recipe. So everybody sort of has like their unique take depending on where you're from, your ethnic background, how you were raised.
That sounds delicious. I actually tried some samosa. I participated just yesterday in the fast just to do it. And I went to a market not too far from where I live called Banu Indian Market and Cafe. And there's a place where you can buy a market, and then a place where you can sit down. And I tried for the first time. I'd never had a samosa with spinach and paneer in it, and it was delicious. I'm a big fan of all kind of like pastry things that are stuffed and fried. There's something that just feels so hearty and comforting about it. Do you think that's part of the why it's a staple, is that it's very soothing, especially after a day of going without?
Yeah. So we usually break our fast with our date and then some water. And then you'll always have people reaching for a samosa just because I think, it's a carb and protein heavy little snack, and it sort of immediately satiates you. And what usually happens at iftar is it's a very communal experience. So it's something that's easy to pass around. And once you've broken your fast and you've had this little snack, you tend to go pray first before enjoying an evening meal. So the samosa, because it's got, it's protein heavy and it's carb heavy, it does fill you up as well, up until like dinner time.
Gotcha. And then you've talked about how there's a variety of potential fillings, but is there anything that you think fundamentally is important for a good samosa?
Ooh, this might be controversial, I'm a big believer in potatoes in samosa, but I know that some people leave it out and they use green peas instead. I like a bit of potato in mine just because I feel like it helps to sort of hold the shape, when you're folding. So I like potato in mine.
I did have to, in addition to the spinach, I did have to order a potato samosa because it is a must have. Do you have any places that you recommend before we let you go? Any places to either buy in your article that you recommend places to get the wraps so you don't have to make the dough yourself, or just somewhere where you can just go pick one up that's already made?
Yeah. So some of the places that sell the wraps, they'll also have frozen samosas, and usually there's a homemade, they'll have like an auntie in the community make it, just before Ramadan, and it's available all through the holy month. So I know Makkah Market here in the South Bay, that's where I got mine from this time around. It is a tedious process, so I did buy some frozen samosas that I've been frying, and having during the holy month. But most Indian restaurants, there's Flavors From Afar. I think they just relocated. I'm not sure where they're located, but they have the African style samosas, the Somali samosas, which are really good. Those are very heavy in meat. So usually ground beef or lamb. Those are really good. But yeah, most Indian or Middle Eastern restaurants will have samosa on the menu. And like you mentioned, potato is a very common filling option. But also there are meat options as well.
That all sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Yusra. Thank you for writing this article and also for talking food while fasting. You show extraordinary strength. That's Yusra Farzan, our reporter here at LAist. You can read this article and also her extensive daily news reporting at LAist.com. Yusra, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Julia.
This is Air Talk on a Friday. Thank you so much for being with us today. Just want to say thank you to the exceptional staff that we have here at Air Talk. If you've ever wondered why is Air Talk an exceptional show, of course, Larry Mantle and Austin Cross are superstars, but the staff here, chef's kiss, wonderful. So thank you guys so much for everything that you do here at LAist, and thank you to the listeners. An additional thank you to everyone who gave during our spring member drive. Thank you for allowing us to cut our fundraising down to 6 days instead of 10. That was pretty cool. Hope you all have a great weekend, and stay with us for Weekend Edition, while I'll be back with you on Saturday and Sunday morning and LAist.com for all of the storm updates. And never forget about the LAist app, where you can stream us, listen to podcasts, and also see our news headlines. LAist.com. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. Amy Nicholson writes on film for the New York Times and hosts the podcast Unspooled. We're going to lead off with the sequel to Godzilla vs. Kong, which came back out in 2021. Godzilla, Kong, The New Empire, just out, starring Rebecca Hall. Adam Wingard is the director. Tim?
Yeah. Godzilla, Kong. I guess we just sort of figured that out. The 2021 film, Godzilla vs. Kong. Not this. This one, they're working together a little bit. They get around to it. And because it's a sequel, it features many of the same people. So we have Rebecca, we have Brian Tyree Henry, we have Kaylee Hall, a few other people from that 2021 movie. The movie that kicked off the series, though, was actually that 2014 film, Garth's film, Godzilla, before Kong gets mashed up into the picture. We'll talk about those in just a second here. This is great fun. It's a big, dumb movie that tries to explain with scientific language about how we get to a place called Hollow Earth and why there are all these gigantic titan monsters and bugs and everything around it. And, you know, hey, look, that's all fine. I prefer it when they don't try to explain it. Let's just let the monsters fight, boys. That's all we really need to do. But there's a lot of comedy in this film. As opposed to, let's say, even that 2014 film, or more recently, something like Shin Godzilla or Godzilla Minus One, which are serious films. They're kind of like that Raymond Burr film.
Yeah.
Big giant monster, yeah. Yes. Subject matter, very serious. This alludes to some interesting things about humanity and how we confab with nature and whatever, but this is just big and dumb. And fast with Dan Stevens as a big gigantic ape dentist at some point. And you know, when they need something in this film, you know what they do? They make it up. They just make it up. Kong hurts his arm. You know, we happen to have built this gigantic metal Kong arm that we got it over there. Okay, let's just roll with it. Look, in some ways, trivial, particularly if you've recently seen like Minus One or Shin. But fun. And I think that's all you really need is fun in this. You know, the Kong in this is really amazing. He stands up upright for one thing. Not like that Peter Jackson film where he was on all or most of the films. Kong in these films stands upright like a dude. And Godzilla, when he gets mad, he goes pink. Pink. And I think that's on purpose.
Godzilla, Kong, The New Empire, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, what I like about Adam Wingard's take on the Godzilla franchise is he knows he's just making a big, dumb monster movie. I mean, Godzilla Minus One won an Oscar this month. This movie is not going to win an Oscar. This is not an Oscar movie. It is just loud and large, and it knows that if you are a person who wants to go in and see a very good-looking, ridiculous B-movie, That's what he's going to give you. Because he has actually, I think, great visual flair when he tells these Godzilla stories. His use of color is amazing. Yeah, the pink atomic breath. He's just painting mountains pink and purple in the background just because he can. A lot of slow motion, speeding things up. I mean, but what I really, I think, respect most of all about his approach to Godzilla is that he lets the animals just act like animals. They're not that obnoxiously anthropomorphized here. He goes a little bit more emotional with Kong in this one than he did in the last one. Last one, Kong is just a beast. Loved it. But here, he's letting Kong, I think, transition into being a little bit more of like a personality. There's a really good scene in here that I think shows the kind of control that Adam Wingard can have when he's really working at his best in this franchise, where Kong meets a bunch of monkeys and one of the monkeys tells the other monkeys a joke in monkey. And the whole thing is wordless. It's like, I don't know, 5 minutes.
Yeah, but it was funny to me.
It was so funny.
I got it.
Yeah, you got to be a good director to pull that off. Yeah.
Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, rated PG-13. It's in wide release. Wicked Little Letters, a British comedic drama starring Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley. It's directed by Thea Sherrick. Amy.
Yeah, this is a very, very funny little British comedy that I could not believe was inspired by a true story from post-World War I Britain, but it actually is. And it stars two of my favorite British actors right now. You got Olivia Colman and you got Jesse Buckley. They're playing neighbors. And Olivia Colman is, you know, Edith. She's this good Christian woman living this very pious life with her family. And Jesse Buckley is being very Jesse Buckley. You know, she's a wild Irish rose singing around. She's a single mom. She's got a boyfriend living with her. And then Edith begins to get these hate letters that are just so foul. They're things I cannot say on the air. They're terrible.
Yeah.
And the whole neighborhood just decides that the person sending them has to be Jesse Buckley's Rose because she's the person who doesn't fit in. This actually happened, and the story became a big deal in the newspapers, and it involved a third character who's played here by Ajana Vasin, who is like the first female cop in this area as well. And so you have these three women kind of solving this mystery. And at first, I was thinking, oh no, this is going to be way too cute, way too twee, way too on the nose about sexism. And it is way too on the nose about sexism. But when you have these three actresses in here, it just becomes ferocious. And I found myself getting pretty involved in who is actually sending these letters.
Mm.
And
Timothy. Timothy Spall. So he really has the juiciest thing in this movie, to be honest, because he gets to speak those letters out loud lots of times in this movie. And he does it with this energy, this vitriol. They're really foul letters, mostly sexual, but nevertheless done in that sort of Irish/British sort of way. But I'm like, whoa, somebody wrote that in 1920? Like, somebody wrote that in
1920? Because, again, this was a true story.
You can look those letters up. You can look them up. I looked them up. And he gets to say that. He gets to say all of that stuff in this movie. And there's this whole trial and things come out. And it was just so much fun and so ridiculous. And at the end of the day, it's kind of a women's empowerment movie in an odd sort of way for 1920 or something like that, whatever it was. Yeah.
The movie is Wicked Little Letters, directed by Thea Sherrick, Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley star. It's rated R. You can see it at AMC's The Grove 14, AMC's Century City 15, and then next week it expands it to a wider release, Wicked Little Letters. California is an Italian drama. The film is directed by Alessandro Casagoli and Casey Kaufman. Tim, what do you think of California?
I like this movie very much. Those two directors you mentioned made this lovely little documentary called Butterfly, 2018, that covered a boxer from Italy, a young woman boxer from Italy, in the boxing club that she was in as she worked her way to a bronze medal in those Tokyo Olympics. While they were filming that, there's this other young girl who was just roaming around that boxing gym, who's just fantastic, and she's the lead in this movie, Jafari here, and she was so captivating. If you've seen Butterfly, you'll know why they chose her as the lead for this movie. And what they did is they incorporated her actual life. She's a young Moroccan girl. Then she was about 9. In this film, she's about 13. And they follow her in real time, like Linklater's About a Boy, how he followed that kid for X number of years. They do that with this young actress. For the next 5 years, they follow her, working this narrative story that it's also reflective of her actual life. What does she want? She wants to go what she calls home, to Morocco. She remembers Morocco. five, six, 7 years old. And her family, hardworking, her big sister, her mother and father, who are never around because, you know, they're working there in that little town in Naples. All she can do is think about this really sort of mystical, magical Morocco in her child's mind. And she wants to go home. And we follow her over these years as she does everything she can, including working at the salon called California. And it's only called California because when the owner ordered the sign, she spelled it wrong. And the little girl kept telling her, no, you don't spell it like that. She ordered it anyway. Now it's a big old dumb sign out there with an E on it. But she's so sharp, this little 13, 14-year-old girl, that the owner eventually lets her start running that shop. And she's handling it all by herself until the social workers come around. Shouldn't you be in school? And then we get that movie. But it's just a lovely, lovely film. This little girl is fantastic. I hope she stays in the acting business. She's going to be great.
We're talking about Ikram Jafari, who's the star of the film, also co-starring Khadija Jafari. The film's directed and written by Alessandro Casagoli and Casey Kaufman. It's unrated in Italian. The two main characters are brother and sister in real life, and you can see the film streaming on Film Movement Plus. That's Film Movement Plus. The documentary Steve, a documentary in two pieces, is, as suggests, an Apple TV Plus two-part documentary on Steve Martin. Morgan Neville is the director. Amy?
Yeah, these two parts of this documentary are divided into then and now. So the rise of Steve Martin and then Steve Martin of the present. And they're both absolutely feature-length, very long documentaries that have their own individual style. You know, the style of then is all archival footage, amazing archival footage, because it turns out that Steve Martin is a person who saved everything. He even at one point presents a postcard that he had written to his girlfriend announcing that he's now going to become an avant-garde comedian. And then the Steve Martin of now is set in the present day where he's wandering around making breakfast. You see him on camera for the first time, and it's a little more conventional where the talking heads are now on camera talking to you, and you get to see him just pal around. The first half of this, the early part of Steve Martin, is really the standout of the two. It's just such a fascinating, relatable story for anybody living here trying to make it in the entertainment business about a kid from Orange County, doesn't think he has a lot of talent, and really has to figure out who he's going to be because he just has to be on stage. You know, the years of him being in debt and needing money and how am I going to get there and who am I going to be? And he kept these real diaries. He astoundingly has this way of being, of showing us that he was very deliberate and methodical about figuring out how to look stupid. And he just reveals all of that. So the first part of this, just phenomenal. And I cannot believe the footage that Morgan Neville was able to turn up. Second part, a little more normal.
More conventional. Talking heads begin. The first part of it, literally, we hear Steve. We never see Steve. We see him in the images and the video from back in the day, but we never see him today. And you don't need to. That's how dense the material is in this movie. Handwritten notes from his diaries. He wrote down everything that happened in every performance. A little slow tonight. I didn't hit that line quite right. The crowd this, the crowd that. We see how he crafts who he's going to be. And look, this seems to be true of so many people, particularly men, I think, driven to heights. He had that mean, grumpy dad. And that mean, grumpy dad, who even when he was a millionaire and The Jerk is 1978, that was the biggest movie in the world for a moment. He was the biggest comedian in the world for a moment. Stadiums, his dad, you know what was wrong with that show? That's his dad.
Wow.
So, you know, if you're out there and you got that dad, hey, keep swinging, kid. Keep swinging.
We're talking about Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces. It's streaming on Apple TV Plus. Morgan Neville is the director. It's rated TVMA. The Beautiful Game is a British sports drama. Bill Nighy, Michael Ward, Callum Scott-Howell star. Thea Sherrick is the director of the film The Beautiful Game. Tim.
Oh, I love this movie. It's as ordinary as the dirt that you play soccer on, but I don't care. It's fantastic. Bill Nighy plays this guy who was formerly a very important soccer player. And he's leading this team in the U.K. He's going to take him on this international tournament. He sees this young black man playing with these kids in the park. Hey, that guy can play. We need to get him on the team. Now, Bill Nighy knows something about that guy. He knows the thing about that guy that's true about all of the guys that are going to play in this international tournament. This is a real tournament. Started in 2001. All of the players are homeless. They're all homeless. I actually saw a piece about this. I don't know, maybe it was ESPN or something like that. And he engages this young man, Michael, and he says, look, I'm not homeless. It's one of those movies.
Yeah.
And we go and we have this ordinary movie where they go and they play in this international tournament in Rome, and the extraordinary Valerie Golina is in this movie. Oh, my God, my heart almost stopped when I saw her. It's just this movie that plays out exactly the way these movies all played out. I'm crying like a baby watching this movie, fully knowing everything that's going to happen. And then they show this montage of the end of the actual folks from these actual teams from around the world. And I'm just like, yeah, you know, it's just so wonderful. This is ordinary. And it's grand, and I love it.
The Beautiful Game is the film, directed by Thea Sherrick, who has a second film out this week, Wicked Little Letters. She directed both of them. The Beautiful Game, starring Bill Nye, is rated PG-13, and it's streaming on Netflix. Let's at least get started on Dog Man, which is a French crime thriller, and actually it's English language, even though it's from France. Caleb Landry-Jones and Jojo T. Gibbs star. Luc Besson is the writer-director. Amy, please give us about 30 seconds. We'll break and come back.
I can start off by saying that this is a very, very weird movie. It's best to watch this movie, I would say, as like an acting exercise for Caleb Landry-Jones, who I think is just this really interesting actor. He's a very intense oddball who likes going for the strangest movies possible. Here he plays a paraplegic drag queen who commands an army of dogs, and the movie opens with him arrested, dressed like Marilyn Monroe in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And then from there it goes into a, I bet you're wondering how we got here. And I guess we'll get to that in a second.
We'll continue, find out more about Dog Man, which is set in New Jersey. The film is rated R. It's in select theaters. We'll also hear about the documentary Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told, which takes us back to Freaknik on the streets of Atlanta during the 80s and 90s. Those and more movies coming up. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. We'll be back with more with Amy and Tim in just a minute. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3, and as always, if you joined us late and you missed what our critics had to say about the biggest films of the week, no worries. You can listen whenever it's convenient for you, wherever you get your podcasts, or at LAist.com. Our critics this week are Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell, and Amy was just starting us off on the Luc Besson film Dog Man, starring Caleb Landry-Jones.
Yeah, when we left off, Caleb Landry-Jones was getting arrested dressed like Marilyn Monroe. There are a million different ways you could pull this movie apart and refuse to engage with it. I mean, starting with the fact that it is pretending it's set in Newark, New Jersey, but is very obviously shot in Europe with a bunch of European actors in the back supporting cast. I would not recommend watching Dogman for its half-baked ruminations on God and forgiveness, or for a totally boring subplot in here about a lady social worker and her abusive ex-husband. But I would recommend watching this if you're at all curious to see how far Caleb Landry-Jones is willing to go in a performance where he's wearing old school leg braces and false eyelashes, a scene where he lip syncs an Edith Piaf song and is in its entirety. I mean, it feels like this movie was made because Caleb Landry-Jones is worried he's never going to get to play the Joker, you know, which is Hamlet for young actors. So if he never gets to play the Joker, here he's kind of doing a combination Joker and Batman all at once, a bizarre version of both. In an art house style.
Dog Man is the film. Tim.
If the Joker spoke like Donna Reed, which is the way he speaks in this film, he's like, and there's a reason he does that from these magazines. He has this really terrible childhood. His father, vicious father, who trained dogs to fight, makes him grow up inside this kennel with all these dogs. He literally lives in the kennel, this vicious brother. This is classic Luc Besson. And then he delivers a whole bunch of wacky characters. One crazy, really, the paraplegic cross-dressing transgender guy, not the craziest guy in this movie. Not the craziest guy in this movie at all. And I suppose what Amy says is true. He is astounding in this role. He is just pulling this role to pieces. And he's extraordinary so that you sit there completely engaged in this film where there's not a believable moment in it.
Yeah.
At all. But he's fascinating.
Dog Man from writer-director Luc Besson is rated R in select theaters. The documentary Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told, takes us back to the street party in Atlanta of the 80s and 90s. Tim?
Yeah, in 1982, to be specific, around the Atlanta area, D.C. Atlanta area, all those historical black colleges, some folks got together and said, well, you know, we can't really afford, and sometimes they're not really welcome at some of the places where spring break happens, Daytona and places like that. So we're going to create our own picnic party, Freaknik. It's a portmanteau. And they started doing it. 82, 50, 60 people the first year, 100, 150 people the second year, 2,000 people the third year. By the time you get to the middle, late 90s, 150, 200,000 people attending these parties. Now, they don't have these anymore. And there's a reason for that. And that's in this movie, too.
As so often happens with spring break events.
We know that I think in Florida this just passed.
Yeah, this happened in Miami. Issue. Palm Springs. And then they had all kinds of problems. Had to stop it in Palm Springs.
But as these things grew, as these freaknicks grew, they became a cultural touchstone for black Southern America. These events were a font for Southern hip-hop. Lil Jon, all those cats came out of this. They didn't perform there. It was a lot of soul in hip-hop and R&B, too. 1983, I was stationed in Washington, D.C., had me a little freaknik. So I know how this goes. This is kind of controversial over on Hulu because your parents are probably in this movie.
You're freaky parents.
Steal
right?
yourself for that. Your 25-year-old parents are not something you want to see.
Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told is unrated. It's streaming on Hulu. It's directed by P. Frank Williams. Asphalt City is a thriller starring Sean Penn and Ty Sheridan. It's directed by Jean-Stéphane Sauvier. Amy, what'd you think of Asphalt City?
Yeah, Asphalt City is a movie that's really trying to just be, I guess, Taxi Driver of the modern age, where the taxi drivers are paramedics driving around in New York that basically looks like something out of Hieronymus Bosch. This is a movie all about doom and gloom and screaming people in misery, and the dog even gets shot. It's a rough, rough, rough film. You've got Ty Sheridan as kind of the rookie paramedic, and you've got Sean Penn as the cynical one who's been there a long time. It's the kind of movie that's just so on the nose with its metaphors that even though Ty Sheridan is playing this guy from Colorado who's supposed to be timid and overwhelmed, he walks around the whole time wearing this bright red jacket with angel wings on it just because they want to make a point that he's an angel walking around all the sinners of this earth. I found this just gloomy, 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 and it made me sad because I like Ty Sheridan as an actor, and this movie is not doing him any favors.
Asphalt City, Tim.
This movie's over 2 hours long, and that's really what the problem is. If it stuck to the thing that it's actually about, the sort of gritty realism of those movies from the 70s, you know, Friedkin and all that kind of stuff, you know, we're just gonna be in this real world space watching these people do what they do. I'm gonna leave it alone. We're just gonna do the End of Watch is a recent one. Jake Gyllenhaal and
that's a good one.
I really liked End of Watch. Yeah,
and they're just doing their cop thing. But it's just a daily. When this film is that, just the daily, it's intense. That first scene, oh my God, grabs you by the throat, and it does that about four or five times through this movie. Then you got all that other space where we have to talk about our feelings, it takes the energy out of a film that I think otherwise might have just been an interesting, just sort of this is what this is like.
So go back and see the Under the Radar End of Watch instead of Asphalt City, starring Sean Penn, Ty Sheridan, is rated R in select theaters. The Irish action drama In the Land of Saints and Sinners stars Liam Neeson and Kerry Condon. Robert Lorenz, the director. Tim?
Period piece set during the early 70s, during the Troubles in Ireland. And we get our Liam Neeson playing a different guy than he usually plays in most movies, yet he's still playing the same guy because at the end of the day, you don't want to cross Liam Neeson in any movie that he's ever in.
Yeah.
So he's that guy. But in this movie, he's a killer. And he's killed a lot of folks. And he's moved himself out to this bucolic little town in Donegal or wherever it is in Ireland where nobody knows who he is or what he does. After one of those terrible things goes down where a child is killed in front of a pub that some IRA members set a bomb, he has to do a job. And that job leads some people to wanting to take him out, and they come to this town. So he has to do what he has to do to protect this town. But is he a saint or is he a sinner? This is a really, really good movie. And, you know, because I poke a lot of fun at Liam for making the same movie over and over again. But this just goes to show that you can play that guy without playing that guy.
In the Land of Saints and Sinners, starring Liam Neeson. It's written by Mark Michael McNally and Terry Lone. Robert Lorenz directed. It's rated R in select theaters. The comedy Lousy Carter stars David Krumholtz, Martin Starr, and Olivia Thirlby. It's written and directed by Bob Byington. Amy.
Yeah, this is almost more of an anti-comedy from Bob Byington, who is this Austin cult filmmaker who has enough of this kind of underground rep that he can get some really good talents in these low-key, low-budget movies. This is about a professor, that's David Krumholtz, who learns that he has 6 months to live. But the joke of the film, the joke that you're kind of not laughing at, but you're quietly snorting at, is that he's just not the kind of person to do much about dying, or he's not the kind of person who's going to be missed when he's gone, that nobody in this film cares. Not his like therapist, not his doctors, not his mistress, not his best friend, not his students. Nobody really cares whether or not this man lives or dies. And so after a while, all the ways in which this entire world that this professor is living in is just cold and miserable start to stack up, and you just can't do anything but laugh about it, you know? And so when you let this tone of this movie kind of work on you, it becomes good in a way where it's also just off-putting in every single frame. You know, it has a strange rhythm. I don't think it even wants to be a good film in certain ways. The technicals are bad. The editing is bad. The sound mixing is bad. It's just all about that tone of apathy. And the performances are working on here. I also really love, there's a actor-director, Jocelyn DeBoer, who's in here as the mistress. Oh, she's so funny. And Stephen Root as his therapist has some of the best lines.
We're talking about Lousy Carter. The comedy is at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown L.A. and available on demand. It's unrated. The documentary, The Lie, The Murder of Grace Mullane, is about a true crime story. It's directed by Helena Cohen. Tim?
Yeah, devastating. An international story. 2018, young Grace Mullane was killed. 2019 is when this trial happened. But for her actual murder, everything about her murder is documented in this film by videotape. Videotape in the hotel room, in the hotel where she was killed, elevator, foyer footage, all this kind of stuff, the park where her body was taken, all of that was documented in New Zealand by video cameras everywhere. So we have this guy who was accused of a murder. He tells this story about how they were involved in rough sex and he accidentally strangled her to death. That videotape is in this film too. And they juxtapose him telling this ridiculous story against the images from all of these cameras, literally hundreds of cameras, that they can time code every moment of what actually happened, as I said, but for her actual murder. It's very devastating. In some ways, I felt, it felt like a violation of, me, her family. Her family's very much in the film during the period, her trial, her father, a very strong figure in advocating for the telling of the truth about what happened to her. But it left me feeling like I had watched a snuff film. So I don't know. It depends on how one engages these sorts of things. I'm a ridiculously emotional person. And that was tough. This young woman is all over this movie. And knowing exactly what happens makes it really difficult to look at live videotape of what happens.
The Lie, The Murder of Grace Mullane. It's available on demand. The movie's unrated, directed by Helena Cohen. The Listener is a film that stars Tessa Thompson, also directed by Steve Buscemi. Alessandro Kamen is the screenwriter of the film. The Listener, Amy.
Yeah, this is a very, very, very small film that feels like Steve Buscemi is trying to get his confidence behind the camera, and it doesn't quite work out for him. The idea is that this is set during the pandemic, you know, right when quarantine hits. So kind of flashback of all of that, people calling and wondering about masks. And the listener is Tessa Thompson, who's playing the woman at the other end of this helpline where people can apparently, it just seems, call up about anything, any distress they're feeling in this very confusing time. And so what you're watching is just only her. You have all these celebrity voices who are calling in, you know, Aaliyah Shawkat, Margaret Cho, Casey Wilson, Rebecca Hall, even from Godzilla, taking her time off from Godzilla. And she's just trying to figure out what they need to hear. The problem with the film is that this is also about a woman who is burned out at her job and not very engaged. And so you're watching a person who's not engaged hold conversations with people and doing a bad job, which is pretty tedious after a while. But there are a couple scenes in here that I really like, a couple callers who are good. The best one is she gets a call from this incel guy who really gets under her skin talking about his attitudes about women. And she finally has a tiny spark of life. But otherwise, I think Steve Buscemi didn't do a great job as a director pulling anything out of this performance.
Trees Lounge is the last feature I remember from Steve. That's got to be 25 years ago. Has he done anything between Trees? I'm sure he's done some television directing. But Trees Lounge, I think, is the last.
I remember Trees Lounge. I enjoyed that movie. Film. Yeah,
yeah, kind of a you know, a lounge movie.
Yeah, yeah. The Listener is the movie we're talking about, directed by Steve Buscemi. Alessandro Kamen wrote it. Tessa Thompson stars. It's unrated, available on demand. Femme is a British thriller starring Nathan Stewart Gerrit and George MacKay. The film's written and directed by Sam H. Freeman. Ung Chun Ping. Tim, what'd you think of Femme?
Yeah, this is actually a very powerful film, an adaptation of a little short that they made a few years ago that I think was in Cannes or something like that. We meet Jules, a young black gay transvestite man. Cross-dressing man, joyous life, having a fabulous time. He's a big star at this club where he performs as Aphrodite. One night after he performs, he goes out. He sees this guy checking him out, you know, eyes contact, that kind of thing. Nothing happens. They go on about their business. He goes into a little shop. Same guy sees him, but this time he's with his manly friends. Says a couple of gay slurs. Our guy, under his breath, whisper something. You didn't say that when you were looking at me 20 minutes ago. You know, one of those kind of things. This leads to a vicious, vicious, humiliating beating of that guy. Destroys him for quite a while. Goes into a shell, stops performing. One night, months later, he goes to a gay sauna. He sees that guy. He's not in drag, though, so that guy does not recognize him.
Nah.
He decides to start a relationship with that guy. He decides he's going to get revenge on that guy. And we get that movie. This is really, I mean, as a thriller, absolutely, totally it works. But it's a film that speaks to this thing, this real, real thing. It's even better. Again, harrowing. He is beaten so severely in that scene that I told you about, in the context of the scene, left naked on the street. This happens. This is not made up.
Yeah.
This has happened. So they go there in this movie. And it sort of explains, and they have to, because he wants revenge, and he has to have a good reason.
Femme is the film. It's a British thriller. It's unrated, starring Nathan Stewart Gerrit. You can see it at AMC's The Grove in Beverly Hills. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, Joseph McBride, author of Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, Joe's new book, looking at Billy Wilder, his family fleeing Europe during the Holocaust, coming, of course, to Hollywood and having such a huge influence both as a writer and as a director. We'll talk about the life and career of Billy Wilder with Joseph McBride coming right up. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3, and if you missed any of the reviews with Tim Cogshell or Amy Nicholson, you can hear just exactly what they had to say about all this week's films at laist.com/filmweek or by listening wherever you get your podcasts. Much more to come in just 90 seconds.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
Amidst the ruins of Berlin, trees are in bloom as they have never been. Sometimes at night you feel in all your sorrow a perfume as of a sweet tomorrow.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. You're listening to a song from A Foreign Affair, directed and co-written by the great Billy Wilder. Marlene Dietrich singing in English, German, French, and Russian, reflecting the fact that Berlin was divided into four zones at that time. We're going to be talking about Billy Wilder and the tremendous impact of the films that he wrote and directed over his extensive career in Hollywood. Joseph McBride, film scholar and professor, is author of Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, which is now out in paperback. Joe is professor at San Francisco State University, where he teaches film history and screenwriting. Joe, it's so good to have you back with us today on Film Week.
Yeah, Larry, it's wonderful to be with you. The first time we were together was back when I did my Frank Capra biography. We had a wonderful time in the studio, and it's nice to talk to you again.
I appreciate it. Well, Wilder, of course, with an incredible body of work during his career, Double Indemnity, arguably the greatest of the film noirs, The Lost Weekend, A Foreign Affair, Sunset Boulevard, Ace in the Hole, Stalag 17, Sabrina, The Seven-Year Itch, I mean, the Apartment, Some Like It Hot, Witness for the Prosecution. The list is incredible, but what stands out to me, Joe, is the diversity of Wilder's work, that he seemed so comfortable in so many different styles of films.
Yeah, that's true. And he told me that as much as he admired Alfred Hitchcock, he didn't want to do one kind of film. Like, Hitchcock was known for the suspense genre, and Wilder didn't like to be pigeonholed. And he was a guy with a very peripatetic sensibility, and his mind moved very fast. And he was called the racing reporter when he was a newspaper reporter. And so he liked to go from genre to genre, and within genres, he would blend them. Like A Foreign Affair is an amazing film because it's a romantic comedy set in the ruins of Berlin. Who else would do that?
He lived into his mid-90s and reportedly was on his feet most of the time. I mean, this was a guy who even late in life had tremendous energy, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was, when you interviewed him in his office in Beverly Hills, he was moving around all the time, as you said. And he would do that with his writing collaborators, Charles Brackett and I.L. Diamond. He would be the guy who was pacing back and forth with a riding crop or a cane in his hand. And when he worked with Raymond Chandler, that was one of the things that drove Chandler crazy, that Wilder was waving the stick around. But he was, his mind went a mile a minute. He was one of the best interviews. Did you ever get to interview him?
I didn't. I so wish I would. I've heard him, of course, interviewed in many documentaries. And so I have a sense of him from that, but I never got to talk with him, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's a good interview by Volker Schlondorf, the German director, a three-hour interview. There's an American DVD called Billy Wilder Speaks, which is cut down, but it's still vastly entertaining. I'd recommend that. And Michelle Simont did a wonderful documentary on Wilder as well.
Let's talk about his formative years. He, like other creative people who had to flee Europe because he was Jewish and because of the Holocaust, he lived in Vienna, so had influences of this tremendous artistic center of Europe. But share with us how he made his way to the United States.
Well, yeah, I'm very interested, as I've been a journalist myself since 1960, and I met him on the set of The Front Page, his newspaper film. And he was a newspaper man from age 20 in Vienna, and then he wanted to go to Berlin, which was the big center of culture in those days, in the 20s, and it was extremely exciting and had all kinds of newspapers and magazines. And he wrote human interest stories, and there's a collection that Noah Eisenberg has put together of some of the best of them. His best journalistic piece was a three-part series on being a tea dancer, which was dancing with ladies for tips at a hotel in Berlin. It would make a wonderful movie. But he wrote films in Germany for a while, but he was very savvy. And he could see the writing on the wall when Hitler was rising to power, and he got out of there very fast, went to France, made a film, and then he fortunately got a job in America writing a film, but his visa ran out after 6 months, and he had to go to Mexico to try to get back in the U.S., and a very sympathetic assistant consul let him back in and told him, write some good ones, and he got into the U.S., permanently in the mid-1930s became very fond of America. And he said the best thing about America is the Supreme Court. I don't think he would feel that way today, but he was a very liberal-minded guy, and he liked the freedom in America.
We're talking about the great writer and director Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, Joseph McBride's critical study of Billy Wilder and his career. It's now out in paperback. Ernst Lubitsch, the great director who preceded Wilder in coming to the United States, was a big influence on Wilder. And in fact, he had a motto up in his office that was representative of that. What did Wilder say about Lubitsch's influence on him?
Right. He had this sign on his wall painted by Saul Steinberg. It was, "How would Lubitsch do it?" And he always looked at that and he said, "I never wrote one page without thinking about my mentor, Ernst Lubitsch." Lubitsch, when he hired Wilder and Charles Brackett to write Ninotchka, that was the turning point in Wilder's career. He was foundering a bit in Hollywood in the 30s, but within 6 years, he was writing this classic film, and it made him an A-list screenwriter. And he always, Lubitsch, I did a book on him called How Did Lubitsch Do It? Lubitsch was very oblique and subtle, and he would think of clever ways to get around cliches. He hated cliches, and so he would tell a story with one or two images or a little sequence, silent, often a silent sequence, because he began in silent films. And Wilder emulated Lubitsch's way of storytelling, but he said, "I never quite could do it the Lubitsch way. Nobody could do it like Lubitsch." Although I think that the best of Wilder's Lubitschian films is an underrated film, Avanti, 1972, with Jack Lemmon and Juliet Mills. It's just a wonderful, delightful film about two people in the modern day kind of reenacting their parents' romance. And it's kind of a very conscious throwback to the Lubitschian style.
Wilder has a number of his films on the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress. The first of them chronologically is the great noir film Double Indemnity, starring Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck. This takes us back to 1944. This is the scene in which the two lead characters meet.
Is Mr. Dietrichson in?
Who wants to see him?
My name is Neff, Walter Neff.
If you're selling something.
Look, it's Mr. Dietrichson I want to talk to, and it's not magazine subscriptions.
Listen, Mr. Dietrichson is not in.
How soon do you expect him?
He'll be home when he gets here, if that's any help to you.
What is it, Nettie? Who is it?
It's for Mr. Dietrichson.
I'm Mrs. Dietrichson. What is it?
How do you do, Mr. Dietrichson? I'm Walter Neff, Pacific All Risk.
Pacific All what?
The Pacific All Risk Insurance Company. It's about some renewals on the automobiles. I've been trying to contact your husband for the past 2 weeks, but he's never in his office.
Is there anything I can do?
And of course, she is. There is something she can do. Joe, just real briefly, because we need to break, but that film, what did Wilder say about his approach, particularly with the casting of Fred McMurray?
Well, McMurray was a sort of all-American guy, saxophone player, but he had this kind of innocence and boyishness, but he was also a wisecracker and a slick operator kind of guy, and Wilder related to that, and he wrote a screenplay that McMurray was in the 30s called Champagne Waltz, which is forgotten, but it was the first recognizably Billy Wilder character on the American screen. And he was great in Double Indemnity. He wasn't the first choice, but he was just perfect because he was ensnared by this the ultimate femme fatale, Barbara Stanwyck. And then Wilder gave him another amazing role in The Apartment in 1960, where he played a real heel, a real bastard, and he had to talk him into it. But McMurray realized that Wilder penetrated into some, dark section of his soul and brought out some great nuances in his personality. And some woman, when McMurray was at Disneyland, because he starred in Disney films, some woman came up to him after The Apartment and hit him over the head with a purse and said, "Why are you making movies like that?"
Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, book out in paperback from Joseph McBride, who also teaches film at San Francisco State University, author of other important books about film. We'll continue our conversation on Wilder on Film Week when we come back in just 1 minute.
Look, Baxter, I'm not stupid. I know everything that goes on in this building, in every department, on every floor, every day of the year.
You do?
In 1957, we had an employee here, name of Fowler. He was very popular, too. It turned out he was running a bookie joint right in the actuarial department, tying up our switchboard, using our IBM machines to figure the odds. So the day before the Kentucky Derby, I called in the vice squad, and we raided the 13th floor.
The vice squad?
That's right.
Well, what's that got to do with me? I'm not running any bookie joints.
Just what kind of a joint are you running,
sir?
Jack Lemmon, Fred McMurray from the 1960 romantic comedic drama The Apartment, directed and co-written by Billy Wilder. We're talking with Joseph McBride about his book, Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge. And Joe was just talking about the casting against type of Fred McMurray, both in Double Indemnity and then later in The Apartment. Joe, you know, share with us what the writing approach was of Wilder, because his dialogue just snaps.
Yeah, that was written with I.E.L. Diamond, who was his invaluable collaborator in the later part of his career. And they had a very simpatico relationship. Wilder was always had an accent, and he was a bit self-conscious about his English, even though there was nobody in I've ever met who was wittier than Billy Wilder. And he was famous for his ability to, at a moment's notice, to give wonderful quotes and hilarious comments. But he liked to have somebody who was more comfortable in English, and Diamond had come from Romania as a child, but when you come as a child, you adapt to the language more easily. And but they just had a worldview that was similar. Diamond called Billy Wilder a disappointed romantic, and I think that was a real key to what I was writing about, because Wilder is often considered a cynic or a misanthropist or a misogynist, and I don't think those things are true. I think he was a guy who had a tough veneer that he had developed because of his being in exile several times over, fleeing Hitler, being a newspaper guy in the 1920s, and surviving Hollywood for a long time. But he was, as Jack Lemmon said, underneath he was a softie. He was a very warm-hearted guy. And The Apartment is a great film. I asked Wilder, when I gave him the Career Achievement Award from the LA Film Critics, I said, "What do you think is your best film?" And he said, "The Apartment." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because it's my best mixture of comedy and drama." And he said, "That was the mixture I was going for my whole life."
Another film, of course, on the National Film Registry, Sunset Boulevard, starring Gloria Swanson and William Holden, and its look at the underbelly of Hollywood. But even in Sunset Boulevard and the acerbic commentary about Hollywood there, there was poignance to that film and dark humor as well. That tonally was an extremely sophisticated mix, Joe.
Yeah, the mix is key to him. You know, as we were talking about, he blended genres, and he it's a love story with Nancy Olson, who's wonderful, and she's still with us, delightful yeah. lady. She was this wholesome young lady who was a story editor, and when I was in Wisconsin, I thought she was a little too good to be true. But when I came out to Hollywood to be a screenwriter, I met a lot of story editors like that, and, you know, well-educated, idealistic young women, and there are people like that, and she's the counterbalance to William Holden's sordid relationship with Gloria Swanson, who also stirs your heart, you know, because she's a tragic character. When Andrew Lloyd Webber was doing the musical version, Wilder said it should be a grand opera because she's a dethroned queen, you know, there's a grandeur to her. And Holden is the patron saint of all screenwriters, that guy who's struggling to avoid going back to the copy desk in Ohio and and he's, you know, kind of reduced to being a gigolo. But it's a really honest look at Hollywood. Although I said to Wilder, it's like a documentary, and he said it's a Valentine. You know,
I guess that's one way to look at it. Beginning with a guy floating in the pool, and his body is narrating the story. We're talking with Joseph McBride, Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, now out in paperback. Let's listen to this clip. This is one of my favorite Wilder films, and it's, I think, a little less well-known. From 1951, Kirk Douglas stars as cynical reporter who's on the skids trying to regain a job at a major newspaper, and he spends a year in Albuquerque. Douglas's character, Chuck Tatum, has had enough in Ace in the Hole.
You know what's wrong with New Mexico, Mr. Wendell? Too much outdoors. Give me those 8 spindly trees in front of Rockefeller Center any day. That's enough outdoors for me. Those subways smelling sweet sour. What do you use for noise around here? No beautiful roar from 8 million ants fighting, cursing, loving. No shows, no South Pacific. No chic little dames across a crowded bar. Worst of all, Herbie, no 80th floor to jump from when you feel like it.
Kirk Douglas in Ace in the Hole. Joe, your thoughts about that film and what Wilder said about it.
Well, I love that film. Being a newspaper guy myself, I can recognize the honesty of that portrait. I mean, obviously not all newspaper reporters are that corrupt, but there's a lot of lying and corruption in that business. And we're often lied to by the press. And, you know, Wilder wanted to be completely frank and honest. It's one of the most daring American films. And the public rejected it because it's also an attack on the American public for being gullible and wanting sensationalism. And Wilder, you know, read a review attacking it, and he was feeling bad. And he walked out of his office, and he saw a guy on the street who had just been hit by a car, and some photographer was taking his picture. And Wilder said to the photographer, "We got to call an ambulance and get help for this guy." And the photographer said, "You do it, buddy. I'm busy. I got to run," you know. And so he thought then, well, I told the truth. And, you know, that's one reason Wilder is called a cynic. And I once called him a cynic without thinking. And he said, "But if I'm a cynic, what adjective do you have for Peckinpah pictures?"
good. That's a very good point. Peckinpah, of course, directed The Wild Bunch, among a number of other films, with a great degree of cynicism and violence. Joe, thank you so much for coming on. I also loved your part of the book where you wrote about Wilder's interest in doing Schindler's List and all the back and forth with Spielberg over that, and then what Wilder thought of the final film. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about the paperback release of Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much. Joseph McBride with us on Film Week. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. We look forward to having you with us next week for the next Film Week here on LAist 89.3. Have a terrific weekend.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.